Succession number 23787, reel 11.
Major Dillon, reel 11. Now, what happened after you? I mean, you've done these two staff officer positions, one attached to the military mission, to the
Greek brigade,
the Greek brigade, one to the thing. What happened next, basically?
And then, as end of time, I come home.
What year would that be?
Oh my God! Now you ask me. Where are we now? 48.
About
48. I'm posted home to the 1st Battalion of the Beds and Hearts Regiment, who were amalgamated with us, at the School of Infantry Warminster, where we were the demonstration battalion.
So it's 1st Battalion Beds and Hearts?
Yeah.
How did you feel about sort of not being with your own unit?
Well, it had happened. They were all right. We got all right. There was another. Humphrey Wilson was also there, second in command, so I wasn't the only. And very quickly, we were sent out to Egypt as part of the Guards Brigade. I'll make this as short as I can. We were the demonstration battalion of the School of Infantry, which was demonstrating the battalion attack, the company in the attack and all that sort of thing. The students watched whatever we were doing. We were suddenly posted from there out to Egypt, where there was trouble with Mr. Nasser and all that, if you recollect. And we found ourselves in the Guards Brigade. We get to...
So whereabouts had you gone to there?
Isman, in the neighbourhood of Ismailia, what the hell's the name? Well, Ismailia is near enough. I forget the name. There was a camp, but I've forgotten what it's called. It was in the desert. It was open. We were in huts and canvas, which suited me. I'd been in the desert before.
And what was happening there?
We were security for the canal zone, which we still ran, you know, and guarding the canal. And most of our tasks were preventing the natives, the locals, stealing a signal cable. They were pulling up copper cables and pipes and stealing it, and training. And we're told that at one time, this was before NASA did anything, that because of this, I don't think people know about this, there was a strong suggestion that we might reoccupy the... Egypt again. By now we were just in the canal zone, if you recollect. And in fact we implaned twice. But it came to nothing.
Did you think this was going to happen?
I think we did. I remember being briefed by the Brigadier Algie Heber Percy, who was a great Grenadier Guard. He said, "Dillon, you're not paying attention. What's your objective in Alexandria?" I said, "It's a sporting club, sir." He said, Well, how do you get to sport?" I said, "I know the sporting club, so I'm a member of it." Don't be cheeky. It was that sort of atmosphere. And it all came to nothing, of course. And then Humphrey Wilson left and went out to the battalion that was in Korea.
Now, were you actually the 1st Battalion Beds and Hearts?
Yes.
Or that's what they were still called?
Yes.
You hadn't joined up?
No, they were Beds and Hearts.
But you knew you were going to join up with them?
We didn't know. Not really, no.
So... Humphrey Wilson left.
Humphrey Wilson left to go out to join our 1st Battalion, which was by now in Korea. I felt guilty. Should I try and go to Korea? I thought, well, I've done enough fighting. I'm quite prepared to admit. Perhaps I should have done. But on the other hand, it's rather like deserting a sinking ship. We're supposed to be part of this Guards Brigade, which is about to reoccupy Egypt. I was rather ambivalent about it. Anyway, I stayed.
And did anything happen while you were in Egypt?
Not really. Not of any significance, no.
How long were you out there?
What happened? I can't... Honestly, about 6 months, I suppose, was it? I'm getting a bit so very, very vague now. And then the next thing was... coming home... I forget whether the battalion came or I came home, and was now posted to the Royal Norfolks, who are now in Hong Kong, having finished in Korea. So I got to Hong Kong, where I was joined by family, and had a happy, happy, whatever it was, 18 months in Hong Kong. And having listened to the Empire Windrush, you know the next stage of...
Well, what happened in the 18 months in Hong Kong?
Well, we were the garrison supposed to defend the colony of Hong Kong against the might of China, which was a bit of a joke. And we spent our time building defences and wire on the frontier and patrolling and exercising. And it was a marvellous sporting place. I was a keen yachtsman, had a yacht. The men went swimming and played football. It was an imperial outpost. For instance, if you took your shirt off before it touched the ground, somebody picked it up, washed it and ironed it. It was, one thought it might go on forever, but of course it didn't. It was glorious.
And what do you remember of the trip home on the Empire Windrush? Because that's the one that was caught fire.
The one that caught fire. She was a very happy ship. We knew nothing, of course, of what was about to happen. The only inkling was the fact that Miriam got to know the captain quite well, who any time of the day or night, if you went on deck, there was the old man paddling up and down. And she said, "Why don't you sometimes come down and have a drink with us in the schooner?" She said, "No, I won't. All I want to do is get you people home." He knew. The ship had continuous breakdowns. He had, in fact, tried to refuse to sail on the outward journey because he knew the engine room was in a hell of a state. And he was told that I think the first time the HLI were going out to Korea. He said, he was told there only soldiers. He said, "Well, that's all right, because I'll take just soldiers. But I must come home empty." When he got to Korea and then Japan, he was told to take wounded and families, which were on board when we got there. He said, "I refuse." They said, "Captain," I'll get his name in a minute. It's in the book which is behind you. "We can find plenty more captains if you're not prepared to." So he agreed. "But I won't take any more passengers." He got to Hong Kong and he was told to embark the likes of us. We broke down at Aden. We broke down at Colombo, then at Aden. And then this final disaster.
Now tell me the story of the final disaster, as much detail as you remember.
Towards home, we were in the Western Mediterranean off Algiers. We'd had our Dîner d'Adieu sort of piss-up party. It was before entering the Bay of Biscay. Everybody went to bed very high and happy. At about 6 o'clock in the morning, all the lights went out, and there was a dead silence. You know, engines stopped, there was nothing.
So it was a total failure?
Total silence, and the children were up, as always. They said, "Daddy, Daddy, something's happened, the engine stops." And I remember saying, "Oh, shut up and go to sleep." And then the stewards came round knocking on the doors, as you heard in the film. Everybody on deck. So I told the children to go to sleep. They said, "But Daddy, the engine stopped." And then shortly afterwards, a steward came round and said, "Everybody on deck with light bells, the ship's on fire." So we got on deck, and in an orderly fashion, and started to realize the fire was very serious to such an extent that the mechanical means of lowering the lifeboats had failed, because all the auxiliary power in the ship was electric, and with the explosion in the engine room, all auxiliary power had failed. For instance, when we first got up, the ship was still under power because there was still some oil in the pipes leading the engine. We were steering in a circle at 15 knots because there was no power on the helm. The situation was obviously very serious, but we paraded.
Now, had you practiced your boat drill and other things?
Yes. Oh, yes.
A lot.
Falling in at boat stations. But as far as the lowering of the boats, that was the crew's responsibility, and one had nothing to do with that. But they were unable to do it. This was a ghastly thing. All the winches and mechanisms were electric, and there was no power anywhere. So you had to get, for instance, 60 soldiers get their backsides under a boat and push it over the side, where it dropped 70 feet in the water. Some landed the right way up, some the wrong way up, some with a hole in them, some floated, some didn't. But the four boats with the women and children were lowered by hand. By you know, about 50 soldiers on each rope, gradually lowering. And they were lowered successfully by hand, and they all got away. All the women and children and boats got away.
Where were you, and where was Miriam?
I went down, saw Miriam and the children into their boat, and then went back to my boat station, which was on A deck, I suppose. I forget. Anyway, the saloon deck. And stood there. The boys stood on the burning deck. And there's an incident which I shall never forget. Out of the smoke came no less a figure than RSM Gilchrist, DCM, the Royal Norfolk Regiment, who was coming home. He was the only other Royal Norfolk on the ship coming home with me. Actually, under a bit of a cloud, but that doesn't matter. He was coming home. Dressed as only an RSM could be dressed, immaculate. Brass his belt, stamping of feet and saluting. Permission to go over the side, sir. He was an Irishman. I said, Mr. Gilchrist, you and I are both passengers on this ship, so it's nothing to do with me. But I do understand that the order abandoned ship has been given. That's all very well, sir, but I thought I should get it for one of my own officers. Which was... So then he disappeared into the smoke. And
was there any panic at all?
I didn't see any. There were a lot of funny incidents.
Tell us some of them.
One, a friend of mine, a cavalryman, I think of his name in a minute, lives in Norwich. He was a troop deck officer. I was not a troop deck officer because I was a passenger, charge of passengers, getting them over. Had been down on his troop deck, ordered them all on deck. If you imagine, there are no lights. There's pitch dark down there except for emergency lights. The second time he went down, there was still a man in his bunk. And he said, didn't I tell you to get on deck? Ugh. Get on deck at once. There's a fire. He said, well, I better get a third time. Third last hour, I go around and make quite a feeling in each bunk space. It's pitch dark down there. This chap's still in his bunk. Didn't I tell you to get on deck about fire? Yes, sir. Well, why aren't you on deck? Well, I was on fire picket yesterday. It's nothing to do with me. It was that story.
Any others?
And then the same chap telling a story, like I'm telling you now, about the adventures. And his parents had had a dinner party in Norwich. He was regaling them with adventures. And he'd said that he'd lost everything, but he had saved his motor car. And the way he saved his motor car was a thing known as grey funnel line, if you were in the Far East. If you knew the skipper of an aircraft carrier coming home and you bought him a bottle of whiskey, he would agree to put your car on the flight deck at your own risk. If it was washed overboard, a storm, well, it's gone, but it didn't cost, it cost you a bottle of whiskey, you see. So he put his car on this aircraft carrier, and he got home safely. And he was saying that he'd saved his motor car, and Mrs. Mopp had heard this. She was doing the washing up in the kitchen, you see. And next morning in the pub, she was heard to regale this story. That was terrible, that Empire Windrush. Disgraceful. All them soldiers are swimming in the water, and the officers are lowering their motor cars into the lifeboats.
Any others?
I can't remember any particular ones.
So after you'd met Gilchrist, what happened to you next? You were at your post.
I did this. I don't know whether I was right or wrong. I decided that, again, being a yachtsman helps to know that, all right, there's very little, there's not much wind, the sea's reasonably calm. The lifeboats are by now dropping into the water like paper bags, some the right way up, some the wrong way up. They appear to be moving, they're not moving away, but the ship is. Because of the wind. And I thought, well, it's no bloody good to have lifeboats 100 yards away, is it? How are people going to get into them? So I had a fit of sort of... I was physically fit then. I said, well, whilst I can see a boat alongside, I better slip down, get in it, and then nip over, and I managed to swim. I got two tied together and got them alongside, and then...
They wouldn't drift further away?
What Peter is the ship that's doing the drifting because of the wind is, you see. The ship is that tired. The wind is pushing. Anyway, I managed to get two or three. Then another soldier joined me who had the same idea. We managed to get these things alongside. And we started people started getting down the ropes and ladders and pulling away. Now, I remember when I eventually got into the boat I was in, it was half full of water. It had no bottom in it. You see, it landed with crashes. You could see the sea through the bottom, but it was just floating on its buoyancy tanks. And a chap in one of the boated lifeboats takes some more men. I said, not much point because they'd only sink. And we got alongside this Dutch ship, which we've heard about. And there was the Dutch skipper. He had a box of cigars in one hand and a bottle of Benedictine in the other, which he was issuing out to the passengers. And I said, it's all very well. He said, have another one. And I said, well, it's all very well. Who's going to pay for this? I don't know. He said, not me. I think probably your queen will pay. Anyway, then we eventually got to Algiers, where the French, imagine this was Bournemouth on a Sunday morning. The French commandant had obviously been rather like Captain Manning, said, this is my big moment. I will declare martial law. He closed down all the buses and sent them down to the docks, every bus in town. He ordered the commandant of the barracks to send all the troops out to go out into the hills. He ordered the local Harrods, the stores, to close, but be ready to open at once for clothes for the women, which Bobby Scott found. We arrived, various ships arrived, and the buses took us. The families were taken to this holiday camp, which the commandant had evacuated, told them they ought to go and get lost, all the holiday makers, for the families. The soldiers were put in the barracks where they were issued with French uniforms. We were put in the thing, and there was, if I recollect, there was red wine for the soldiers and champagne for the officers. But I mean, this is the French. It was marvellous. And we all got together and gradually realised we were all right. And then HMS Triumph appeared from Gibraltar. HMS Triumph was a training aircraft carrier full of young officers under training to take us to Gibraltar. So we all were taken down to Triumph and got on board. And it was the most wonderful thing to be, you know, again safe and on a British ship. And there was a sort of panic moment. Roger, my son, was missing. Tannoy loudspeaking, calling Roger, searched the ship, can't find him. Eventually a midshipman found him. He'd locked himself in the heads and he couldn't reach the bolt. It had clicked. It was a Yale thing. And he was only about, he couldn't reach the bloody thing. Fortunately, this midshipman found him. And his memory to this day, his happiest memory of HMS Triumph, they were asleep. They'd all been, they'd put beds and things down for them. Sleeping on the flight deck next to a jeep. He thought that was marvellous.
And that was pretty well the end of the story.
Well, then we got to Gibraltar, which was incredible. It so happened Lady Mountbatten was there. Well, she didn't miss a trick. She had a band of Royal Marines playing on the quay and waving and saluting. And the things had changed under British, you know, not French champagne for the officers and red wine for the troops, but endless staff officers with mill boards lining people up and calling the roll. And a friend of mine, Tony Firth, funny enough, his obituaries in yesterday's Times, appeared on the quay and said, come on, old boy, follow me, I live here. So I look after you. See, we cut out all this guff. So we went to his quarter and there we were. And then the next day we flew home. And then the end of that story.
Now, the only other thing I think we want to look at is when you were in charge of the depot at North, the Britannia Barracks. What years were you there? Do you know?
Up until I left. I left in 60, I suppose.
Was it 2-year posting?
3-year posting.
So it'd be sort of 57 through.
Yeah.
And what was it like being in charge of the depot? Was it still the Royal Norfolk Regiment?
It was the Royal Norfolk Regiment. I had the horrendous task of, and I realised that it was time to go, of making the announcement that the Royal Norfolk Regiment was going to be disbanded. Which I'll
come back to that, because that's sort of the end of it.
End of it, yeah.
What was the job in command of a depot? Can you just explain what your role was?
You are the home of the regiment, in that everything starts at the depot. Recruit training, both national service and regular intake, officers in transit, families. For instance, the married family, as they called it, quarters in the Britannia Barracks, Norwich, I used to visit, go round. You could see where the regiment had been for the last 20 years. There were black women, coffee-coloured women, lots of white ones, of course. I mean, because when there's a problem in a regiment, the final stop is the depot. Can't send them in any further, you know. If there's a problem, child, wife, so he's on your list, you bet that. But then the primary function was the training of the national servicemen, which was a fascinating job.
Well, tell me about that. What was your opinion of the whole system of national servicemen?
It was excellent. It was highly attuned by the time I got there. The selection process was very careful. The training course was very good. The instructors were excellent. And that film, which you may have seen, they had a film about it. It was absolute rubbish, this bullying they tried to show. It did not set it out in the depth of the role, and nothing like it ever occurred. It was fairly hard, but very fair. And an interesting statistics, the average gain in weight after 18 weeks national service training was 14 pounds, nearly a stone they put on in weight. The average recruit, having been fed properly, physically exercised. And
now, what about some of the characters in the barracks at the time? Did you have any?
Yes, there were several. Tim Creasy, which you've heard, who became a general, was my... I'm idle by nature and managed to collect useful people. Freddie Herring was the adjutant who'd won the Sword of Honour at Sandhurst, been awarded a decoration in Korea, was a Russian scholar, so he took all the hard work off my shoulders. Tim Creasy was the training officer. Winky Fitt, the RSM.
Was this the first time you'd served with Fitt?
No, he was in Korea and came to... I see Winky Fitt in... he was in Germany. He was in Germany, that's right. He was a company I made in Germany. No, he was a weapon trainer. He was an NCO in Germany. So I knew him.
What did you think of Winky Fitt? Because, you know, he's quite a figure in the Royal Norfolk Regiment. There's no two ways about
I had a great rapport with Winky Fitt. I like to call him a friend, and he was my son Roger's hero.
What was he like then?
Winky Fitt was unique, but he was a dedicated Royal Norfolk man. I mean, you couldn't...
What was so special about him?
He was large, strong, very tough, but a good shot, and a great carrier. For instance, the recruits were all terrified of him, which they needn't have been, but they were. I always remember the RSM's address on the day of the passing out. There was a passing out parade every 10 weeks or whatever it was. There was a VIP, like the mayor of Norwich would have lunch with me in the mess, and then we'd go out at 2:15 to take the parade. At 2:00, Winky Fitt, the RSM, made his address, and I could see more or less out of the window. Winky Fitt would lurch out of the sergeant's mess, wiping the beer off his moustache, standing upwind of the men. They could breathe this great wave of beer coming out. And there might be 150 men on parade. He said, "Now, you men, you'll shortly be passing out. Some of you will be going to that there Malaya. Some of you will be going to that there Africa. Some of you will go to that there Rhinai. You'll be going all over the place. You remember what you've been trained to do. You're all well-trained soldiers, but the two things you've got to watch out for when you go abroad, one's the drink and the other's the women. If you take my advice, you keep away from both of them, you'll be all right." That was Winky Fitt's, always his advice to the recruits. The drink and the women. Keep away from them, you'll be all right. Well, they were his downfall many times, I think, both.
Was he difficult to handle as RSM, or was he, you know, was he...
I found not. Provided he knew that I knew that he was a rascal, that I wasn't a duffer. I'd been around. We got on very well.
So he had to respect you?
Yes, he did. He was very loyal.
Any other NCOs of note?
There was Sergeant Major Harnett, who was a PT instructor. And there's a lovely story of Harnett and Fitt, who were both reprobates. They were pissed as anything in the sergeant's mess. It was like about 1:00 in the morning. They thought it was time to go home to their wives. They came past the officer's mess, where there was some tulips in flower in the... There's a little round bed in front of the officer's mess, so they thought they'd, if they took some tulips, they'd perhaps be in good odour with their wives. They're on there giggling and laughing and plucking these tulips, and out came Major Gribble, her name was, an ATS major, a rather stout lady, who was the orderly officer. This halt, who goes there? And shone her torch on these chaps. You can't do that. She realised it was the RSM and Mr. Harnett. She had enough sense to switch the torch off and retreat into the mess. So they took to their heels and disappeared in the darkness, but that's a sort of winky fit type story.
What was Harnett like then?
Harnett was a great ladies' man. Well, most of those PT show, they rippled their muscles and, you know, they were... Well, they performed...
What was his first...
Harnett, I forget what his Christian name was, but he... They all performed a very significant part in the selection process, because you had to... The officer selection process started at the depot, potential officers, like university graduates or scholars or whatever. The first list would be produced, and each of the senior NCOs was required to fill in a form. What they thought RSM fit would say no bloody good or okay, I could do with him or something. Harnett was very diplomatic when he didn't want somebody. He knew he wouldn't be suitable. Being a physical training chap, he would say he used to put in the box, weak in the abdominals, no guts. Weak in the abdominals. I knew exactly what he meant, weak in the abdominals. So they were a good team. You had a very good team. Well, I had a very good team. I was very lucky.
Anything else about your time there? You were there 3 years, but yeah. I know it's a routine job. Anything else you remember?
Well, there was a tremendous social life.
But tell us about that.
The Royal Norfolk Regiment was, although I say myself, probably very much part of the Norfolk society. We had a regimental ball, which we issued 400 tickets. My life was absolute hell. All kinds of knobs would ask me shooting, or would I like to come to a dance or something. All they wanted was an invitation for their wives to go to the ball.
Can you tell us what was a regimental ball like? Because no one's actually mentioned that before.
Well,
how was it organised? What
well,
scale
it was. There was a list. Everything in the army is a list of who'd been on it before. And it was the aim of most people in society in Norfolk to be on that list. And you, one of your duties as depot commander was organising the ball.
How did you do it?
Well, you went through the list. We had a committee, always had to have a committee. And what do you think? We went name by name, and God, we can't ask that shit again. Or, yes, he's all right, tick him, you see. And the invitations would go out. And you thought, well, that's right. Then the telephone.